line and to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode number 309, and my guest is Weston Wilson. He is an MMA fighter, and I thank you for being here, Weston. Good to have you.
Oh, no, thanks for having me, Richie. Appreciate it.
Now, Weston, in our last edition of Articles of News, we brought up an article that talked all about you, and I said, you know what? Let's see if we can get Weston here in the Cultural Hall. So I hit him up on Facebook, and he said, yeah, you bet. So here we are. Talk to me about being an MMA fighter and a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, it's actually been really cool to see over the past decade the changes in the church's perception of the sport. As I've previously stated in the past, like, when I first started in high school in about 2007, a lot of people gave my parents and gave me a lot of scuff about it, and you know, were appalled that, you know, somebody preparing for a mission would go, you know, and fight and do these kickboxing tournaments and these jiu-jitsu tournaments and, you know, get in a ring with somebody.
It just seems like they're two totally opposite things, right? Like, when I think of a missionary, I think of a very patient, a very sort of loving, you know, okay, people are going to slam a door in my face and I'm not going to do that. And then when I think of MMA fighters, I think of bloodying up and bludgeoning the other person to the point that they don't want to go on anymore.
Yeah, one's patient and the other's aggressive, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of that happy medium. I've actually learned, and it's funny, my wife will say the same thing. The times when I can't train, I become less patient. It's through training that I've actually learned discipline and patience, and I can let a lot of stuff go. And you would, right, like you said, you wouldn't think that. You think, like, fighting and you got all this testosterone raging and you just want to, you know, always throw hands at people and it doesn't go your way, but it's actually the opposite. Like, because I'm always training and because I'm always, you know, hitting stuff in the gym, I'm kind of like, when stuff happens, I'm like, eh, I don't care. Like, it's not that important to me. So it actually has the opposite effect. I've become a way more patient person, a way less angry person than when I wasn't training. Like, as a kid and a teenager, I was always like, ready to throw down and fight. I got in so many fights at church, but now that I, like, I'm a fighter and I train and I do this professionally, like, you could say whatever you want to me, I probably won't react.
So let's talk about that. Let's dial the clock back a little bit. Before you were doing MMA, you mentioned just now fights at church. So tell people, where are you from? Are you a convert to the church, a born member of the church, or talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I'm like a seventh or eighth generation member of the church.
Okay.
through my dad's side, through the Wilson line. And I grew up all over. I was born in Orange County, California. I actually now live back where I was born, just because work took me out here. But we moved around a lot as a kid, and so I was always in different wards. Growing up in Oklahoma, I was like, we lived there until I was 14. I would fight all the time. My dad was the bishop of the ward, and my wife and I actually met. Her dad was my dad's first counselor, so we'd have, like, family barbecues and stuff, and he's actually older than me by a couple of years, and we actually got into a fist fight at church, her.
Wait,
and I.
You and your wife? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you have to tell me the story.
Tan.
You have to tell me the story.
So my wife had gotten a spray tan. I was like 13. She was 15. And we were doing some, like, water balloon fight at neutral or something like that. She was not participating at all. And I went and I threw a water balloon in her face while she was sitting out on the side. Just came up. Thought it was hilarious. She was mad. She ran off because it was potentially going to ruin her spray tan.
Uh-huh.
So I go about my business. I have my back turned. She comes storming out the doors, tackles me from behind, starts hitting me. Well, I'm like, all right, it's on. Like, I don't care. She's older than me, 13-year-old kid. So I throw her off. I'm getting ready to hit her in the face, and I get tackled by a leader, and he's like, you don't hit girls, blah, 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 you know, whole thing. And then I was like, whatever. I told my dad. And the whole joke was that one day I'd end up marrying Jennifer, and, you know, 12 years later, it ended up happening.
Yeah. So. That's an awesome story. What a great way to fall in love. But so why were you so angry? Was it just teenage angst?
It wasn't
angst,
so much
or what
angry
was it?
As just I was really small. I was a late bloomer.
Okay.
And so I was kind of like a chihuahua, you know, like you're not going to push me without me putting up some sort of fight, even if I was going to get beat up.
Uh-huh.
But I was crafty, you know, in a sense that I knew I had one punch and I could get away. So I always threw the first punch, and if they were bigger than me and I knew they'd beat me up, I just had to be faster than them. And that was what I do a lot in Oklahoma, was I had to hit and run. But yeah, I was picked on a lot because of my size. And so I didn't want to, like, I was never going to let anybody bully me just because they were bigger than me.
And
that happened quite a bit. So.
So this is, you know, you're talking, this is now 15 years ago. This is just sort of like the turn of MMA becoming even remotely popular, right?
Yeah, that's actually when I saw my first UFC events was back then, early 2000s. So I was in fifth, sixth grade, seventh grade, and that was kind of when I was, you know, teased and picked on. And in Oklahoma, everybody's bigger, and they get held back a year and everything else. So, you know, I wasn't one to step down, and I started wrestling at that time too. And so that was kind of my first introduction into MMA. And then we moved to Virginia. I was a part of a top team out there for wrestling in high school. We were a nationally ranked team. And then we moved to Brazil, what should have been my senior year, ended up being my junior because I got held back. And that's where I got into MMA, was my dad said, hey, there's no wrestling. Like, I know, you know, you're trying to be a college wrestler and everything, but I'll let you do MMA, which is another dream of yours. And so my dad and my mom, I think, regrettingly, allowed me to do it. And that's kind of where I got my start.
What were you guys doing down in Brazil?
My dad works for the DEA he's retired now. And so his job took us down there.
Okay. What was the church like for you down there?
Same as everywhere else. It was a little different culturally, but we had like a half English, half Brazilian ward. And it was really good though. I didn't like mutual down there.
Yeah. How come?
I just, at that point, like, I was repeating my junior year. I was 18, you know, and still expected to go to like these young men's things. And finally I took a stance like halfway through my junior year, and I was like, look, I'm 18, mom. Like, normal people would be done. Like, I'm done.
Right. Over it. I'm not going anymore.
Yeah. And so then I didn't end up, I was 18. I still had to go to young men's, even though I was older. And then they called me to be a primary teacher, like right after my junior year. So my senior year, I was as a primary teacher, and I didn't have to go to young men's anymore or anything like that. And that was awesome.
Were you able to employ any of this stuff that you were learning in MMA in your primary class? Because some of those kids can be pretty terrible.
Yeah, you know, I was junior primary. My primary class was actually, like, it consisted of all, this, like, 6 5-year-old boys and one girl.
Wow.
They were pretty rowdy. Not as bad as the Brazilian kids. I had All-American kids.
Uh-huh.
Not as bad as the Brazilian kids, but, you know, they'd give me a run for my money. But it was fun. I had a lot of fun with them, and we do a lot of like fun little games and activities.
So your parents finally conceded and let you start to do the MMA since wrestling wasn't an option. How was that? Was it immediately like, oh man, this is great? Or was it, oh man, maybe I thought incorrectly that this was the thing I wanted.
No, it was immediately great. Like, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, I'm going in, I'm training, I'm getting hit. Like, I don't know how many times I broke my nose in the gym. I got stitches. Now when I fight, like when I'm training, like, I never break my nose. I never get stitches, nothing like that. No black eyes. Then I was like, just getting beat up every day, but I was happy getting beat up as like this 17-18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid, and I loved it. I'd go in, I'd leave school, I'd head to the gym from 4 until usually 8 at night.
Oh my gosh.
And from like 4 to 5:30 I was doing jiu-jitsu. There'd be like a 30-minute break, 40-minute break, and then I'd do either boxing or kickboxing, and I'd come home. Some nights, I would even go back and do like a no-gi jiu-jitsu class, like a you're not wearing like the little gamma-looking one that's more just shorts and a shirt.
Okay.
Closer to wrestling with submissions. And so some nights, I wouldn't get home until 10 o'clock at night, and then I would do my homework and go to bed. Luckily, my senior year, I didn't have to go to seminary because I'd already gone 3 or 4 years of seminary. I got to sleep in a little bit.
Let's take a break for a second. When we come back, I want to talk about the decision to go pro. We'll talk about leaving Brazil and coming back to the States. And we'll do all that coming back in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Consumer alert! Consumer alert!
Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. There's an extremely insane computer infection called Zeus ZBot, infecting hundreds of thousands of computers across the world. This infection is super malicious because it puts you in danger by recording every keystroke you make into your computer, stealing your confidential information, including your banking passwords. You could be infected and never know until you have all your money sucked out of your bank account. At PC Laptops, we can help. If you think you've been infected or just want to be safe, please bring in your PC, no matter what brand it is, into any one of our locations right now, and we'll scan it for free. Why are we doing this for free? Because we want to impress you so much that if you or any of your friends need a computer, service, or phone repair, you come to PC Laptops first. Get into any one of our locations right now or check us out at PCLaptops.com. PC Laptops, where computers start at $7.99. PC Laptops, we love you.
Hey, you guys, I want to talk to you about BestDJInUtah.com. Why, that's the company that I have started for doing my DJing weddings and live events. Whatever you need, I am your guy to do it. So whether you're a lifer or a convert to this podcast show, or you just happen to be listening for the first time, if you are in need of a wedding DJ or an MC for your event, or just a DJ for your business opening, go to bestdjinutah.com. Now, I know it says Utah, but guess what? If you want me to come to your event and you're not in Utah, I'll do that too. You're going to have to pay for me to be there, but I'm more than willing to do that as well. It's bestdjinutah.com. Emails there, phone numbers there. Would love to hear from you and then help you make your event that much better. Look forward to hearing from you, and thank you for supporting the Cultural Hall podcast. But it's a show. You knew that. Time for the second block of the Cultural Hall. Our guest is Weston Wilson. And if you like this episode and other great episodes that you've got of the Cultural Hall, consider being a Patreon subscriber. You can go to patreon.com/thecultural hall, and you get to be a part of a secret Facebook group if you become a Patreon subscriber and be able to get the heads up on what episodes are coming down the line and chat with other Patreon subscribers here of the Cultural Hall. Now, Weston, you're in Brazil, and you essentially have to do 5 years of high school. You got to not have to do seminary your final year, but that alone in and of itself would be really frustrating to me to be like, you know what, I'm done. I'm not doing another year. Get me out of here.
I was like, when I was given the option, I was actually kind of excited. Like, it was a hard choice. Like, at 17, you're kind of like, oh, do I do an extra year? Like, it's going to set me behind a year from all my friends. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it was funny. I kind of had these two identities. When we'd go back to the States for the summer, I felt like I was a year older. When I'd go back to Brazil, I felt like I was a year younger.
Okay.
But that senior year, like, I was excited to, because at the time, I loved high school. My time in Virginia was amazing. Like, high school was awesome. When I was in Brazil, my senior year, high school was not awesome, and it was miserable. The only saving grace was I had so many high school credits from classes and stuff. Mm-hmm. I only took like 2 or 3 classes a day, so I was kind of only in high school for half a day.
So like not even being in high school. You're like, it was so great because I wasn't even there.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I would go for like, I'd either go in from noon to 2
or noon to 3, or I'd be there from like 9 to noon and be done. Mm-hmm. My day is over.
And the rest of the time just spent training and beating the crap out of people.
Yeah, training, or I was never really a big video game guy, but, you know, just home, hanging out, talking to my friends back at stateside, you know.
And then obviously you decided to come back to the States, right? You get done with school and then immediately to BYU, or how did that go?
Yeah, I actually served my mission. I left from Brazil and I went to Rochester, New York. I came home to Brazil, and then my dad got transferred out of Brazil to Tacoma, Washington. And my parents are actually still in that area. And I went to BYU about a month after moving to Tacoma.
How was the mission in Rochester?
It was really good. It's cold in the winters.
Yeah,
but I had a blast. One of the greatest decisions of my life. I've talked about this before, is I wasn't going to necessarily serve a mission because I was told by everybody at the gym, like, hey, you know, you really could make it far in the sport. Like, if you stick with it, like, you could do it. Especially back then in 2007, 2008, like, mm-hmm. you didn't get a lot of young kids like, hey, this is what I'm going to do. And this is what I'm training for. And so I had the opportunity to really, you know, go far. But I ended up serving a mission, and I'm grateful I did, because it kind of set up the foundation for everything else. And a lot of stuff I learned on the mission, I've been able to kind of apply that into training, because I don't think, you know, the mission can be one of the most emotionally and mentally exhausting mm-hmm. things, mm-hmm. but also the most rewarding. And when you're training for a fight, it can be one of the most physically and mentally, as well as emotionally, wearing thing. But when you win, it's also one of the most rewarding feelings.
Right.
Because it's like, I just put in, you know, 6 hard weeks of training, plus all the training that you do when you're not training for a fight. You know, you're pushing your body to the limit. I lose about 20 to 25 pounds every fight.
Oh my gosh.
And so like that alone, you know, the weight cut alone, you're like, wow, I did it, you know, another time I cut all this weight. And so when you win, or when you have a fight, even if you lose and you have like a great fight and you know that you gave it your all, you can be content and happy, with the result.
So talk about some of the experiences then from your mission. 'Cause I agree with you. Like, I learned to work hard. While I was serving my mission, I served in Cleveland, Ohio, and some of those experiences of, you know, just learning to study and actually learning that I could study, right? That I could sit down and I could do the same task for an hour, which sounds ridiculous, but up to that point, I don't know that I had ever sat and studied for an hour. But talk about some of the experiences from your mission, or even the decision to serve a mission that now blesses or guides your life.
Yeah. So, like I said, I initially wasn't going to go on a mission. I wasn't 100% sure I wanted to. But while I was in Brazil, I had an experience where, you know, I ran into a guy and he was asking me all about the church, and I wasn't a great Portuguese speaker. I learned Portuguese through the gym, actually, not at school, not anything like that. Like, he's asked me, you know, all these questions about the church. And so I was like, you know, Heavenly Father, if you want me to serve a mission, like, let me at least speak better Portuguese. and so in that time, I was able to communicate clearly and, you know, using, you know, sentence structure that I never use, using words I never use, understanding what he was saying to me. So it was a cool experience. So I was like, all right, you know, I'll go on a mission. And I ended up going Spanish speaking in Rochester. I actually wasn't a great Spanish missionary. I had more success with the English, because in Rochester there's not a ton of Spanish, so it's like half Spanish, half English. And so I actually had more success with my English, and at that point I was so grateful just to be back in America. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have all these heartbreaks when investigators don't want to continue taking lessons because you get so invested. Or like just helping people overcome struggles, and having to really problem solve But then when you don't have anybody to teach, like going out there and working your butt off to start teaching. And really at the year mark, I had this big like change in my thought process of how to do missionary work. Mm-hmm. And I became kind of unconventional at the time for missionary work. It started like people started taking on, but I actually quit knocking on doors. I took more of the savior approach. Like I had a companion at the time and I was like, you know what? I said, the savior, he didn't knock on doors. He wasn't like seeking people. Like they came up to him because he was just about doing good. Mm-hmm. And so I was in a small town, Geneva, New York. And I was like, that's all we're going to do is we're just going to go about doing good. So I spent a whole day, like we called the Catholic Church. Hey, what do you guys need done? And we went and did service for the Catholic Church. And I was like, hey, what, like, and I was like, we need to go to high exposure areas and literally not like ask the help. I said, we just need the help. And when we started doing that, all of a sudden we started getting people like, hey, so tell me about your church. Like, hey, can we come and visit your church? Like, it was really cool. And all of a sudden the missionary work took off in that area. I ended up staying in that area for almost a year of my mission.
Wow.
And I like the approach and the completely like, 180 from maybe how we think it should be, but I love.
Yeah. And we stopped focusing on teaching lessons and more just like, hey, let's get out there and the lessons will come to us. And this was an area that really New York is not a high baptizing mission. But I ended up having a baptism, a transfer in that ward, and that was an area that hadn't had like the elders of the area hadn't had a baptism in like a year and a half.
So what do you take away from that? I mean, that's certainly out of the box. That's certainly you know, not common, as you said. That's taking a completely different approach. What do you take away from it?
Just, you know, and it's the same thing like fighting. Sometimes we think like things have to go a certain way just because that's what everybody's been doing. That's what everybody does. But there's always different solutions for the same problem. And you might get the same result or you might get a different result. And honestly, I think, you know, not only hard work, but smart work kind of trumps all. Like I worked hard as a missionary, but more than that, I tried to work smarter. And so that's like the one thing that really it's always helped me in my life is you don't have to necessarily work hard. You just got to work efficient. You got to work smarter than everybody else. And I'm not saying it's in the competition way, but it's just, you know, and so that's what I learned, like doing the same thing over and over again, you know, can be taxing and can be tired and putting in those constant reps, like knocking on doors, that's constant reps. Like you can get good at talking at people by knocking on doors, but what about doing something where, you know, you're not being so aggressive and being more passive. I think people tend to respond more to that. And so that was kind of my approach was like, why don't we copy the savior? Cause that's what he was doing. You know, he wasn't knocking on doors. And so that was kind of where like the whole approach came from. But it produced a lot of results and it wasn't that I was still physically tired every day because we were, you know, lifting things for people. We were raking leaves or we were pushing cars. I remember this one person, their car broke down and we just got out of our car and we started pushing their car, you know, and it looks a little weird having guys in suits and ties, you know, pushing a car up the block, you know, mm-hmm. But that weird is what gets people interested.
Did you have pushback from companions about serving that way?
No, I surprisingly didn't. I take that back. My last two transfers, I had to train a new missionary. And so I had to train a new missionary. And on my P days, I like to hang out with my investigators, not other missionaries. Mm-hmm. So I was hanging out with, we were, you know, just out shopping with some of my investigators. And one of them sees him riding home to his family in the car while we're, you know, driving to get our groceries and stuff, and he'd like written bad things about me.
Uh-huh.
So my investigator tells me like, hey, your companion's writing bad things about you in his letter home. So in companionship inventory, I was like, Elder, do you have any issues? And he's like, no, Elder, you're great. Like I couldn't ask for a better trainer. But he's like writing about how we're not knocking on doors and we're not doing this, and he thinks it's terrible that I'm a terrible missionary for instead of like planning on knocking on doors. At this point, I'd already been in the area for a year, so I'd knocked on every door
right.
in the town.
Right.
And so it's literally like, so, you know, I pretend that like you know, in the companionship inventory, like I'm pretending that I can, you know, sense that things are wrong and all this other stuff and get it out of him. And then I start quoting his letter home, which was really bad. But it was funny in the end, because then he like comes clean. He's like, yeah, I just, you know, and so he's like, I just feel like we're just not doing enough. And, you know, we need to be out knocking on doors. That's what the mission's about. And, you know, he's out in the mission 2 weeks.
Right. And he knows.
It's understandable.
He knows. He knows what the mission is about. He's been out there for 2 weeks. He's been to the MTC. He knows.
they all tell him, you know, you should be knocking on doors and, yeah, and teaching a ton of lessons. And so anyways, it's funny. So he like comes clean and he feels all bad and guilty and everything. And then so it's like, all right, you can plan like the next week. Like you plan, we knocked on doors and we were knocking on doors and I'd be like, hey, it's me again. How's it going? So and so. Like I had started to know everybody in the town by name.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, no, we're not interested. I was like, cool. So like after like 1 or 2 days of that, he was like, all right, I see it. Like,
I get it.
I get it. You know, and he ended up becoming an AP. He was a fantastic missionary. He was really good. And was a force, you know, in the mission field when I went home. So
that's awesome. Let's take a break. I want to go come back in the third block. I want to keep talking about maybe some lessons that you gained from your mission, and then what it's like to be a pro MMA fighter, what that means, and everything like that. So let's do that. Come back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, a reminder if you don't follow the Cultural Hall on all of the social medias, it's at the Cultural Hall, whether you're doing Pinterest or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, it's all at the Cultural Hall. Weston, it sounds like a pretty awesome experience, a way for you to look at doing a mission a little bit different. Were there other things, other lessons you learned from your mission you wanted to share?
You know, it's just working. I think the Lord puts us with like companions, all sorts of different companions, to help prepare us for marriage, honestly, because like that's what really taught me, like patience was my companions.
Right.
And how to put up with people's differences, and work through them. So that was another big thing that the mission taught me was you're going to have companions you don't like. Mm-hmm. It's up to you, instead of like playing the victim and like, oh, I'm miserable. I can't deal with this person. Like it's up to you to find things that, you know, you can get along over. And I can honestly say like, I really enjoyed each companion. Even if we're not friends, like, you know, where we talk all the time anymore, but I had takeaways from each person I was with. And I think maybe that's part of the mission too, more than just teaching the gospels. It's a refining process for you, as the individual. And as you're on this 2 year or 18 month experience, you know, it gives you a chance for the Lord to refine you into, you know, who you're going to be after the mission.
One of the things that I loved about, as I thought, you know, that similar thing, right? You think about these companions and towards the end, you're definitely thinking a ton about, you know, getting married or who you're going to be with forever. And I remember one of the greatest lessons that the mission with companions and companionships taught me is that I was going to be so excited that I actually got to pick my companion for the rest of my life, right?
Yeah.
Like, hallelujah that it wasn't just assigned and that then I had to figure out a way to love that person, but rather I could find someone who I got along with and whom I loved rather than just being like, you, all right, make it work. It's like, no, thank goodness I can pick.
Yeah, that is the truth right there.
Yeah.
It's so much easier when, but even then, I mean, sometimes marriage is hard too, because you always find new things, you know, about each other, even years down the road.
Right. And people change too, right? Different focus as you have kids, as kids get different ages, as life goes. I would suspect that your wife did not think that you were going to go pro with being an MMA fighter, or maybe she did, but that certainly is a whole different series of issues, or, you know, of life choices for sure.
Yeah, no, for sure. When we first got married, at that point, so like on the mission, I had thought, like, you know, I don't think I'm supposed to fight anymore. Like, I don't think I'm supposed to fight. And so I like kind of halfway through the mission, that turning point I told you about, like, I kind of given up on it. I was like, you know, I'm not going to fight anymore. Like, it's not something I should do. And so I was like, when I get back home, like, I'm not going to fight. Like, I might train and everything, but like, no, it's not something I should do as a person. Like, I chose a different path. So I get home and I'm at BYU and I had gone into the gym a little bit to train and I still, like, oh, I still had it. I still had a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard a talk at BYU at one of the BYU devotionals, about one of the apostles there. I can't remember the apostle that it was. But he talked about how he was good at baseball and he played baseball in college.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that he was going to be a professional baseball player. And then he realized one day that he wasn't, and that's not what the Lord wanted him to do. Mm-hmm. So he quit. So I was like, oh, this is perfect. You know, this is what, you know, I think I'm supposed to do is not fight. So I'd quit fighting after my first semester at BYU. I was like, you know, I'm not going to train anymore. And I focused on getting married and doing the next steps in life, and getting, you know, college under control. It wasn't until after I was married, I was like, you know, I still love the sport of MMA. Like, I still love, you know, UFC. I still love everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't let this obsession go. And so my wife's like, why don't you just take one fight, just to do it and say you did it, you know? Because at that point I'd had kickboxing tournaments, I'd had wrestling tournaments, I'd done jiu-jitsu matches. Like, I had done everything but everything all at once. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like, then each individual aspect of MMA.
Yeah.
I just hadn't done MMA. And so it's like, okay. So they call a promotion. They're like, yeah, we'll have you on. So I was like, I'm going to go back to the gym. I've got 6-7 weeks to train for this. The kid I'm fighting is 3-0, undefeated. Like, everybody thinks he's the next, you know, big thing to come out of Utah in the amateur scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was definitely not supposed to win the fight. I go in there, I beat him. And from there I was hooked. Like, it was like one of the worst fights I'd ever had. Like, I'd gotten hit harder in that fight than any other fight because I didn't know what I was really doing. but I was hooked. And from there I just kept training and kept fighting. And I went, you know, my amateur career was up and down. I had a lot of fights that I prepared for. And I had a lot of people not show up night of fight because they'd see like this 6-1 kid and they'd be like, oh, I don't want to fight this kid. And so I had, I think, I prepared for a total of 11 fights,
mm-hmm.
and only had like 4 or 5 amateur fights actually happen.
Yeah.
Because people would pull out.
You intimidated them. That's
so
all.
At that point, I don't know what it was, but at that point I was like, my coach was like, you know what? Forget it. Let's just go pro. You're mm-hmm. good enough. Like, you're training with some of the best guys in the state, some of the best guys in the world. Like, you're good. Like, don't worry about it. So we decided to go pro. At this point, my wife, she didn't really like the whole fighting thing. My mom was way against it. And my older sister, she kind of didn't like it. My brothers, they thought it was cool. They enjoyed it. My dad was a big supporter. I don't know if I'd still be fighting if it weren't for my dad constantly encouraging me.
Yeah.
Even though my mom was telling my dad, like, hey, you got to tell Weston to quit. Like, you got to tell him he needs to focus on finishing college. He needs to focus on getting, you know, getting a career and providing for his family.
Sure.
And I was doing all those things. Like, that's the thing is, you know, your parents don't live with you at this point anymore. Like, my parents aren't living with me, so they don't know my day to day. Like, I was working a 40-hour work week. I was, you know, going to school full time, and I was training full time. The only thing that was really suffering was I wasn't necessarily home with my family all
right.
as much as I should have been. Which I've now like carved out a big chunk of time to be with my family as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get to that point, luckily I'm at a point in my career and with my work I work with now, the company I'm with, where like if my family's feeling a little rejected, they'll let me work from home. You know,
awesome. They'll
let me like spend time. So I've got everything kind of like in the position where it needs to be. And it wasn't until like last year, LDS Living, they did an article on me, and a couple other big media outlets were doing this cover on, you know, the Mormon fighter, MMA fighter, who's fighting for Bellator. And so that was where my mom was like, wow, you know, and I think that fight was the first fight my mom actually like really watched me do. And she was like, wow, you're actually really talented. Like, so all of a sudden my mom does a 180. And my mom's like becoming a big fan. She watches all my fights,
mm-hmm.
you know, and she's sharing all the articles and all the podcasts and like everything. And she's always like sharing stuff. But I told her, it's like, mom, my goal is like, I want to be, you know, the Steve Young of MMA. Like I don't necessarily want to push the gospel on people, but I just want people to like know that there's somebody in this sport that, you know, is a representative of the church and, you know, can represent those values and be an example to people. Like, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be tattoo filled and partier and go out and fight. Like, you can be somebody, you know, good that has high morals and still do the sport.
One of the things that I loved about the now given up, I'm a Mormon campaign was that it definitely put faces to members of the church who did all sorts of different things, right? For example, with you being an MMA fighter, but then there was also like a professional skateboarder and all those things. And a sentiment that we've shared here in the Cultural Hall a bunch of times is, you know, that being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints doesn't have to look a specific way. You know, I mean, the values are the same, but you can do all sorts of things.
Whatever you want
yeah,
to do.
Yeah. Whatever you want. It doesn't have to be, we look like this, we act like this, we are this, right? We can find it within MMA fighting and skateboarding and tattoos and, you know, all these different things because we share that, the love that we have for fellow man, for members of the church, for the doctrine and the principles that Christ taught. And that's the most important thing, not all the other stuff.
Yeah, and that's I actually, you know, it's funny because my mission president, he kind of helped with that campaign a little bit. I actually reached out to him to be part of it. I was like, hey, can I do it and share my story and everything? It never worked out, but mm-hmm. You know, it I do that was one of my favorite ad campaigns that the church did.
Absolutely. You know, we only have just a couple more minutes left. Is there I know from reading some articles about you, you have started to do like firesides or speaking engagements, talking about what you do and reaching out with that. How do people get in touch with you for that?
Yeah, you can reach out through Facebook or Instagram. It's just Weston, Westin, Wilson. Or I've got my own website, westonwilson.com. People reach out through that as well. I'm actually... I've procrastinated so much. I finished everything. I just haven't done my revisions on it. I actually started writing a book called Gospel Lessons Learned in the Cage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get it published. Hopefully soon I can send it off to a publisher where I take some of these things about fighting and relate them back to the gospel and things like through fighting that have strengthened my testimony. Of the gospel, and so that's one thing I'm trying to do and put out there on the market, so that if I can't, you know, do a fireside or speak out, do these youth speaking engagements, at least they can get it that way. And I need to be better about just kind of publishing some of the chapters on a blog through my personal website.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the best way. And I'm usually pretty flexible as long as I have, you know, 2-3 week notice.
Yeah, and that's how I was able to get in touch with Weston, is just through social media, and here we are doing this interview. We ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall 3 questions at the end of the interview, and I'll ask those of you right now. First of all, do you have a calling right now, and if so, what is it?
My calling right now, with the changes, is assistant to the secretary in the Elders Quorum.
Okay.
We had a shake up recently. I don't even know who the new secretary is at this moment, but yeah, that's my calling.
Assistant to the secretary.
I actually never get a go to Elders Quorum because I have a 2-year-old who does not like to go to nursery by herself. So I usually hang out in the nursery with the nursery kids.
Assistant to the secretary sounds like a calling from the office, right? The assistant to the...
Yeah, that's what I told my wife.
Yeah. If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
So my favorite calling I had was the gospel doctrine teacher. When I was in Dallas, like, I was the gospel doctrine teacher, and I absolutely loved that calling. And the other calling I loved was primary teacher to 11-year-olds. I guess that wouldn't be there anymore, but 10-11 year olds, when I was first married, that was one of my callings, and I absolutely loved it. It was fun with those 10-11 year old boys. Well, my class was all boys again, but I had a really fun time with them.
Right, as they're prepping to get the priesthood now, that would be the age of those kids being able to receive
the
priesthood.
10-11.
The last question we ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My faith?
Your faith, as in your faith belief, your however you interpret that, but F-A-I-T-H, your faith.
Yeah, you know, I think it's that foundation that even when stuff isn't going right, and things are really, really hard. You know, 2 years ago, I wasn't making the money I wanted to, and we struggled. And paying tithing every month was very difficult for us, but we did it. And it was because of that faith. And I knew, you know, even when my wife and I'd be like, man, life like just really sucks. Like, we just really need a win. You know, I always had that faith that it'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be like, you know, I didn't get this job, or I didn't, you know, things didn't go this way. Like, I didn't get the raise I wanted. I tried to get into a bunch of different colleges to get my MBA at that point. Mm-hmm. And I got rejected from every school I applied to.
Ugh.
And so I was like, man, I've got no wins going on right now. And it wasn't until I fought on that Bellator card. That was the one win that came my way that kind of set everything else up. And so it was, you know, I still had the faith that everything would be okay.
Yeah.
And I kept working towards everything being okay. And now we're finally in a situation, even though California's expensive and you know, it's great. It's great weather and everything like that. But like, we finally are in that position where our faith is paid off, and you know, it's only given us more faith to keep doing the right thing, and that's what I love about, you know, the gospel, is it teaches us that, you know, the more our faith increases, the more we're going to keep wanting to do good things.
Right.
It's that positive feedback cycle, and so for me, that's kind of what's the most important thing for me, is like just that hope and being able to hold on to that no matter what's going on in my life, you know, the Savior already went through all that for us. And we know that, you know, good things will happen even if, you know, it's our darkest moments. Like, good can always happen.
Yeah. We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week. and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.